Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Neurotransmitters Podcast, a show about everything related to clinical neurology with the goal of reducing your neurophobia. I'm Michael Kentris, and I'm very happy to be talking today with an old friend of mine, Dr. Misty Woodburn, and today we're going to be talking a little bit about concussion. Hey, Misty, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
So good. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me a little bit about concussion and kind of what that involves. So would you mind starting us off with just kind of a basic definition of concussion?
So it's like a basic definition is a direct blow to the head, face, or neck, or elsewhere in the body that with an impulsive force transmitted to the head. So it's not necessarily always a direct blow, like it's like a jerking motion and, you know, force is transmitted and the brain is moving. That can cause a concussion.
Like acceleration, deceleration sometimes, would you, like whiplash can sometimes be associated, things like that. And what kind of like signs or symptoms would we expect to see immediately after such an injury?
Depends on the level of impact. So you can have headache immediately or shortly thereafter within a day or two. Some patients feel cognitively slowed down, so their short-term memory is affected. They can be repetitive in nature in their questions. They'll have like some mood disturbances. So some patients will have like aggression or like anxiety. They'll become tearful, gait imbalance. So like just standing up and, you know, having their basic coordination can be affected. Patients will also like have difficulties in their like sleeping patterns. They'll have difficulties falling asleep or staying asleep. There's dizziness, you know, not just lightheadedness, but like a spinning sensation, like the vestibular system is affected. You know, they'll have neck pain. Some patients will have like an occipital neuralgia. So those are like acute things initially that happens.
Pretty large.
But it's all about the threshold. Yes. It's a smorgasbord.
So tell me about that threshold.
So every patient is different. Not every hit to the head or jarring motion is going to cause a concussion, but everyone has like a symptom threshold. So you can see like a hit or a fall or a jarring motion, and you think that's got to be a concussion. But you have to do an evaluation to see if are they symptomatic. And everyone has like a symptom threshold. So some patients' thresholds are a lot higher. Or I've seen patients initially, they'll have like confusion, dizziness lasting from, you know, seconds to, you know, less than 15, 20 minutes, and it goes away. And then they're asymptomatic after that.
Okay.
And some patients immediately following a hit, they will become symptomatic and go from there. But it's kind of like on a scale.
Yeah.
And so there are some where they call subconcussive hits where, you know, you're not having a symptom onset, but the force enough was subconcussive. Like it just didn't bring on the symptoms, but it was enough to cause concussion, but you're not symptomatic.
And I know that repetitive subconcussive hits are kind of like, would it be fair to say, kind of the hot new area in some areas of concussion research?
It is. And it's what a lot of things that they do is just to kind of measure like the force of the hit and, you know, how many in a practice or time. They have a lot of helmet studies to see that and how that correlates with is the, you know, the athlete symptomatic, things of their nature, trying to like catch it immediately to bring them out or to see like, okay, that was subconcussive, but they're not symptomatic and managing it over time throughout a season.
Okay. So in someone who had a concussion, let's say like an athlete on the field and they're, you know, evaluated on the side of the field or the courts, what goes into that evaluation immediately following?
Immediately following. So depending on the sport, on the sideline in football, there's normally a spotter. So someone that actually saw the hit that can explain to you what happened. But immediately following, like if I'm on a sideline and I see an athlete go down and I'm concerned, we, or if they're down, the team goes out, like the athletic trainer goes out. neurologist, if there's one there, ortho, and then they come to the sideline. To do a sideline evaluation, we normally remove the athlete from the setting because it's a lot going on for them. So like after, you know, confusion can come after one. And, you know, the heightened sensitivity, like, you know, they can get migraineous features. And so you normally we remove them and take them back to the locker room. Some universities have like a kind of pop-up kind of tent to where like you can privately evaluate them too, to bring out some, to decrease the distractions. And you do a neuro exam, but you also have like other components to check the vestibular ocular system as well. So like, you know, you make sure cranial nerves are intact, they're hearing, there's no facial asymmetry. So you have them take off their helmet. You know, if you can, you have them, if there's no neck injury suspected, if they're walking, they can take off their pads. And so you're checking that, like tone, you know, looking at their pupils, you're looking at their extraocular muscle movements, and you're checking like saccades, like you know, smooth pursuits, and then you're checking vertical and horizontal saccades where you have them, you know, like you're standing in front of them and you have your thumbs, what, I don't know, 6 inches apart, maybe more than that. And then you have them look back and forth in a horizontal motion for a few things to see if it's smooth as they go back and forth. Is it causing symptomatic dizziness? And you do the same thing vertically. And then you also check VOR, where you have them have their the thumb is at arm's length, like this in front, and you have them focus on their thumb, and they rotate their upper body back and forth. And then you see if symptoms come up, and you check their eyes, if they're able to continue to track in that slow motion. A lot of patients are symptomatic with that. You check convergence, you know, if it's converging, like not within, no, I think within 10 is normal. Outside of that, they have issues. And then you check their strength. You check, you know, upper body strength, lower body strength. You check their coordination, finger to nose. That can sometimes be off. You have them do Romberg testing that we normally do, but we also, some practitioners do a Fukuda, where they have them with their hands outstretched in front of them, standing up, and you close your eyes and you march in place. And what happens is a lot of people will kind of veer off because they don't have that, you know, that spatial awareness anymore that's been disturbed. And then you have them do like a single leg stance, where, you know, a single leg squat. So you have them stand with their hands on their hips, one knee up, and then they do a squat and they come back up. And then you have them do a tandem walk as well. And a lot of times this is done and you compare it to their preseason evaluation. So that was kind of like a quick and dirty of like a sideline or like in the locker room. But you normally, you know, you do a preseason so you can see like, have they always had issues with finger to nose, dysmetria or tremor at baseline? Do they have difficulty with smooth pursuits or saccadic intrusions? You know, do they have balance issues at baseline to with the Fukuda or, you know, tandem? So you're not basing it off of something, you know, if you've never really seen the athlete. So, you know, where I did my fellowship, we had preseason. And so we had the book there. So you can go over like, this is what their exam was like prior. Do they have asymmetric pupils at baseline? Are they slow to react? That's all there. So, you know, you have a baseline and then this is different. Yeah. And then you also do like the quick of, you know, orientation questions, like, you know, where are we? Who are we playing? What's the last score you remember? Here are 5 words. Can you repeat them back to me? You know, stuff like that.
So is it more of like if there are any abnormalities, like in that coordination testing, in those eye movements, they're immediately like not going back into the game? Or is there like a threshold in how, quote unquote, how abnormal things have to be before
how
you?
Abnormal.
Yeah.
So it depends. So I gave you like the neuro sideline evaluation of it. Athletic trainers have their own. They have their standardized their SAC, where they ask like orientation questions. They ask concentration, where they give a series of numbers and you do it backwards. You know, they have immediate recall, delayed recall. And then they do kind of like a quick strength exam. And so what I would see, because I was formerly an athletic trainer, what we would do is like if it was a number cutoff with the orientation and mental status changes, they were automatically not going back in. What I've seen sideline wise, it's fairly obvious that if you're familiar with the athlete, or say you did their preseason testing, or you have their preseason and you see them in front of you, it's pretty fairly obvious at times that something is not right. So what I've seen with some patients, even behavior-wise, that they're normal, you can see extraocular muscle changes. Like you see saccadic intrusions when you're testing the saccades. You see they're having difficulties. Like there's like a drag when you do the VOR. Their balance is off. And these are, you know, running backs who are known for their balance. So it's the subtle things. Some patients will immediately have a headache, and that is an indicator there. Yeah. Or they'll immediately say, I just don't feel right. I'm dizzy. But you do have athletes that'll be like, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. And so in those instances, you really have to calm them down and to be like, I have to do this for your safety. And once you like slowly go through the test, they're more apt to be honest, or like you can see things. And what I was, you know, they teach you is if you are seeing abnormalities on the exam, or you're seeing personality changes, it's not like this huge where you're like, well, let's weigh the safety is your of utmost importance. And so, yeah, you pull, and you're also talking to, depending on this is football or basketball or soccer, like someone that saw the hit too. So did you see the hit directly? Do they have tape? And so you can see like, hey, it's something abnormal, and then you can go over the play. And then, yeah, it's really helpful to know the mechanism.
That makes sense. And just a quick thing, for those who might not be familiar with the term saccadic intrusions, what does that look like when you see it on exam?
I guess the first time I saw it was one of the concussed high school players. So when I was checking their saccades, where you have, I guess, your thumb shoulder width apart and they're looking back and forth. So it's normally like a smooth pursuit quickly, and then it just stops. It's like a jerk.
Kind of like a break in the smoothness. Yeah.
Yes, it is. And it's quite, if you're looking, you're just like, whoa. And then you have them, you know, do it again. And some athletes or patients have it at baseline. And that's where preseason testing is helpful. And you can do it with, you know, when you check for vertical saccades or with the VOR testing, sometimes you will see it. But, you know, if that is not something seen on preseason testing and you see it there, that's indication that, you know, the vestibular system is affected as well. Yeah.
Gotcha. So let's say you have someone, you know, they've had an injury and you think they have a concussion currently based on your exam or the symptoms, and you have to pull them from the game. So when would you go about, you know, when would they be able to return to play? Like, can they come back in that same game, or are we usually talking a bit longer?
So a bit longer. If you're diagnosing someone with a concussion, it's at least a week that they are not back in the competition. So it's about 7 days standard. If there's a loss of consciousness, it's longer than that, right? So it can be like 14 to 21 days. And a lot of that is also based on the symptoms that they're having. So you put them in, I'm sure you hear when they talk about they're in the protocol, the return to play protocol. Yeah. Most institutions have it, even at high schools, the athletic trainers have it. where they put them through like a kind of a system that they go through before they go back to immediate competition. So it, you know, it starts in the acute phase, the injury onset. So it's kind of like a grass. So you have it shoot up and then it slowly kind of goes down over a 7-day period. So when you have the onset of symptoms, like that symptom threshold is passed and they have like headache or they're dizzy or they're lack of coordination, they're not sleeping right, things of that nature, that acute phase within 1 to 2 days, it's, you just normally have them rest, but it's not a, we don't, you know, cocoon therapy is not something that is done anymore. Like you got to have them in a dark room and no lights and no interactions. Can you imagine giving, this is, you know, these are big life events. If you are used to playing, used to being around people and you isolate them, that's not great. You know, especially, you know, concussion can affect mood. So you have them in like a rest period. They're not physically active, but we would tell patients, you know, do what's comfortable to you. If you feel like watching TV and, you know, your headache gets worse, like turn down the brightness of the screen on your phone, use the blue light filter, you know, things of that nature, take a break. And in that time you can use NSAIDs or, you know, they, you know, the standard is like Tylenol within the 24 hours if you're concerned for like a bleed or anything like that. I think we're in a phase of care where if you think that there's a bleed, you just get them to a CT, right? So you're not really gambling in that. Yeah. Yeah. So within that, you know, those few days, if they have a headache, you can treat it with Aleve twice daily. And then you just have them, you know, for several days resting. And then you do like a graduated return to play protocol. So if it's in a 7-day period, the first 1 to 2 days, you know, you have them resting, you know, making sure they're hydrating. You know, some athletes, you know, they'll either have difficulty sleeping or they'll sleep a lot and you just let them rest. Like there's no like waking up every 2 hours or 3 hours. And then as you go, you know, as they go through that acute phase or that relative rest, you can slowly do like a graduated program where they can start to exert themselves. So you do like light cardio, have them doing like just straight ahead walking or Stairmaster, treadmill, and then you have to see if their neck is involved because, you know, that's going to be a part of it too. I wouldn't say that you immediately start doing trigger points. You know, you do stretching and exercises around that time. And then during that time, they're doing straight ahead. It's like 30, 40 minutes at a time. And then you can slowly bring in like the next day with agility. One thing is some patients, the headache or the dizziness will worsen. And so there was a thing where you kind of back off a little bit and maybe you don't go to that next step of agility or sports-related activity. You go back to like the straight ahead walking or running. But we would do it on like a graduated thing to where it's like, one is like, you know, your relative, you're feeling fine. And three is like, you feel awful. So as long as you stay within that 1 to 2 phase, you're able to continue to be active. It's, I think people, as soon as you're symptomatic, you immediately have to go back to step one. You don't necessarily have to do that. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. With every athlete you have to. Yeah. And then you have to make sure they're hydrating. Some athletes, and regular citizens are notorious for not hydrating. So are you feeling dizzy because you only drank 5 ounces today? and that's why you're feeling like that with working out. So that's a part of it too, eating. And then, you know, you do the cardio, the straight ahead, and then you can do agility things the next day. Then you do sports-related activity, drills, like running back drills, and then you do contact. So this is all each day. It's a progression. And then when you're able to do full contact activity and your symptoms are well controlled, it's not that spike up in symptoms again, and you're stable, you're able to determine at that time, okay, are they ready to go into full competition? Because they've done full contact, full activity, and done well, then they go, then you determine, can they go back to full competition?
I know you mentioned the minimum is typically a week, but in your past experience, what would the average be for most people who have had, you know, let's say a mild to moderate concussion?
We don't even really use mild to moderate anymore.
That's fair.
Yeah. But I mean, I do know that they still, a lot of circles is mild, moderate, severe. But we don't really use that. It's kind of, is it is or it isn't, what I've seen with colleagues that I've interacted with.
Is there any distinction with a concussion with versus without loss of consciousness?
Yes. So a lot of times if there is a loss of consciousness, some of the symptoms are just more pronounced or they last longer. So before you go back to activity, you know, did the headache go away? That's one thing. Has the dizziness gotten better? Has, you know, the sleep pattern changed a little bit? Are they feeling better? The memory changes have gotten better. So it's normally with the headache and the dizziness has gotten better, and then you go into your activity phase. With loss of consciousness, sometimes that symptom amount or time will last longer. So you're not ready to go to that graduated to get to the cardio. They're still pretty symptomatic and you need to. And how symptomatic are they? Is the headache really bad? You know, and this is where the history comes in. Do they have a history of migraine? If they have a history of migraine, they're going to have migraines. You know, so you have to treat the migraine. If they have a history of insomnia or sleep issues, it's just going to be exacerbated after that. So you manage it. Same thing with like mood, dizziness, or, you know, if they have vestibular issues or, you know, orthostatic hypotension prior, that's, you know, those are things you're going to have to take care of post-concussion. Yeah.
Just makes everything a little bit worse.
It does.
Okay.
It does. Yeah. And just shakes up the bottle of Coke. Yeah.
Now, what's the overall outlook for people who have suffered a concussion?
Do you
Let's say the short and the long term, you know, are like people who have had, like, let's say a concussion without loss of consciousness, you know, assuming an uncomplicated course, there's no bleeds on, you know, or anything like that that developed in their brain.
Like they have a mild headache and some coordination difficulties.
Yeah. Like do most people recover spontaneously? Are there people who kind of transition into a longer form?
So most people, like, concussion is acute by definition. It's not something by like 3 months later you're still suffering from. It's really the symptoms from it that you're still, you know, you're still having the headache, you're still having the dizziness, you're still having the sleep issues and so on. But, you know, concussion is acute. So within like, you know, 7 to 14 days, those acute, you know, everything that's gone on has resolved. So it's just really like the symptom management of that. And so if you have patients where, you know, like, as you say, like uncomplicated within a week that they're doing better and they're returning to play, you know, I haven't looked at it in a way as it's going to be debilitating years from now because it's an acute thing. And as long as you're managing the symptoms. So, you know, I've had athletes that, or I've worked with athletes that within a week, they're able to return to play. And some athletes, it's within 2 weeks they're able to return to play. The fear lies is if they are hurt again before their concussion has resolved. And so, and that's where you have to, you know, you understand that it's an acute thing. And, you know, within that 7 to 14 days, there's, you know, improvement.
Gotcha. And, you know, I know we were talking a little bit before I hit the record button. Sports events at the national level, there was a lot of talk about second impact syndrome, which I know is somewhat disputed in some corners, but I was wondering if you would be able to share your thoughts on that.
So I'm unsure if your listeners know what, like, the definition of second impact is.
Please enlighten.
So it's like, it's thought as if you don't recover from a concussion and you have another concussion and then the brain rapidly swells and it's catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
That is what, like,
yeah, like cerebral edema, herniation,
life ending didn't recover from
right.
your concussion. That was something that was thought or fear from before mm-hmm. we have the research that we have now. What it does is, you know, if you are, say you're in that phase of recovering from a concussion, so you had your injury on a Friday, and say come Sunday, the symptoms, the headache have gotten better, and then Monday you're doing like a light cardio activity. And so it's in that time of like symptom management and recovery, returning to play, you mistakenly have another one. All it does is reset the clock. So now we're back at day zero. So you're going to acute rest. And that's saying if it's uncomplicated prior. Now, if you're, you know, you have a brain bleed, that's a traumatic brain injury. And that's a completely different realm.
Yeah. It's certainly much more acute, more risks for various mm-hmm. problems.
Yes.
Now, one thing, I've seen this a couple times in the news, not just recently, but where people, mostly with like American football, where they get like a pretty nasty hit.
I love that you said American football.
Well, you know, we have some international listeners out there. But where people will, they'll get hit, they fall, and they kind of have like this abnormal posturing. Does that have any clinical relevance to doctors on the sideline or in terms of the prognosis? What does that mean?
The same clinical relevance as if you went into the ER and you saw someone posturing. I think we're neurologists. So we're like, oh gosh, the red nucleus. Okay.
Yeah.
So yes, it's the same immediate, you know, reaction that there's initial fear. Have mm-hmm. I seen an athlete do that before? Yes.
Yeah.
And
it
so
looks pretty terrifying.
It is. You always have to remember that on the neuro aspect of it, it's just kind of us. And sometimes you have someone else there with you that kind of, you know, understand, you know, the implications or what to do next. But yeah, mm-hmm. The same feeling that you would get seeing it. Yeah.
So a spinal reflex, essentially, right? So in this particular situation, obviously you have to rule out, like you said, that there wasn't like a massive brain bleed or something mm-hmm. like that that's developing acutely.
Yeah.
But let's say that, you know, there's no evidence of that. Would it then be considered like probably like a spinal reflex, something mediated by either the midbrain pons, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But once you kind of, you got to go through the ruling out part, but yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Those patients are going to the emergency department.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of times. Yeah. So what we, you know, with that sideline assessment, you're on the field and you're initially, it's not even a sideline, you're checking their pupils, you're checking, you know, their tone, you're seeing their really sensation before you even check tone, like how things are, and you're moving them off the field. They're not moving themselves.
They go on the gurney and get carried.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
And sometimes it, you know, it's different. Some patients like pop out of that quickly and, you know, you go from there, but you want to be cautious. Athletes, I love working with athletes, but I also know that you have to save them from themselves. So,
right. Yeah. You know, a lot of driven people.
They are very motivated and it's they're great to be around because, you know, you want to be better right along with them, but you also got to like throw in the reins. But yes, and you can have seizure after concussion too.
Sure. Yeah. From my background, I would consider that usually an acute symptomatic seizure.
Yes.
So they don't normally wind up on anti-seizure medications per se.
Yes. So, and it's very like clear for your listeners, like it's a seizure and it happens quite soon after the head injury. So I've had two patients that have had that. One was a car accident. And the other one was, I think, BMX. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I imagine they go through all the same workup that they would for mm-hmm. anyone else with a first-time seizure in terms of EEG, MRI of the brain, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So the first one was in residency. You had left.
Oh, I wasn't with you at the time.
The first one, yeah. The first one was residency. It came in as an emergency. And the other one, they actually saw me, I want to say, within like a week or 4 days of having like the head injury and then the post-traumatic seizure. And they had already, they were immediately taken to the hospital and got imaging and things of that nature. And they were coming to see me and training to see if it was safe for them to ever kind of ride again.
Do the 6 months wait and see.
Yeah. Yeah. So we just, you know, we did that same kind of thing that we did with, like, you know, you do the slow return to play and you monitor them during that process. And, you know, yeah, they're able to return to activity, but you're also making sure that they don't have another event. But it's, I think we're lucky we're had attendings that had worked with athletes or soldiers that had post-traumatic seizures. So they were very comfortable with,
that
you know,
true.
Following them and taking care of them. Yeah.
Excellent.
I'm like, yeah, you can go to activity. We're just going to, you know, monitor you and you're going to see us back at 3-6 months and go from there. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, one last topic I wanted to touch on. I would see sometimes people who had sustained workplace injuries, and they would usually have, you know, kind of these concussion symptoms. But, you know, I know you said they were more acute, but these are months removed down the road where they're still having headaches, you know, kind of sensitivity to like auditory visual stimulation, sleep impairment, mood impairment. And I know it's kind of a nebulous term depending on what criteria you're using, but like post-concussion syndrome would be sometimes kind of like the label that best fits people.
Yeah.
I remember one lady in particular, she was like restocking shelves and like a dozen stand mixers fell and like landed on her from like 10 feet up. Yeah, well, that's a pretty bad injury too. But what are your thoughts on the term post-concussion syndrome and the treatment of patients who might have it?
So the term is a blanket term. It's kind of an umbrella, like the symptoms that you have after, you know, that acute part of the concussion and the changes that have occurred with the jarring forces in the brain have already resolved. And now you're just left with these symptoms. So it's easier for patients to grasp if you just say, oh, this is secondary to your concussion. So it's post-concussive. There are, you know, people in our field that don't like the term. They prefer to split it up to what you are actually dealing with. You're dealing with post-traumatic migraine. You're dealing with, you know, sleep disturbance or insomnia. You're dealing with mood or adjustment disorder. They don't like the blanket term because some patients kind of cling to that. This is all my concussion. And so and with those patients, you just kind of sit down and you take the time to explain to them, yes, you know, you likely had a concussion, but that acute injury has resolved. You are no longer concussed. And that's, you know, some patients get really mad. I've had patients get really mad at me when I say that. And I try to tell them, I'm not discounting that you were concussed at one point, but it's an acute diagnosis. You know, this happened 3 months ago. You're not still concussed, but you're having symptoms from that. And so what happens is in that acute phase, sometimes the symptoms are not well managed, and that's how they linger. And so, you know, I have heard providers that are fearful of treating headaches post-concussion because they're like, if I treat the headache, what if something else is going on and we miss it because they're not in pain? And then I say, well, if you did a neuro exam or if they had imaging and it was normal, you treat the headache. And so, you know, the first 2 to 3 days, you have them schedule a leave twice a day to help break the headache cycle. And, you know, sometimes it gets better after that and you don't need anything else. Or you use prednisone. Like,
really?
It's the same way you'd give a prednisone burst to treat a migraine. They're having post-traumatic migraine. So you treat it. Mm-hmm.
Like you would
any other migraine. So you give them that burst and taper over like 7 or some providers like 10 or 14 days, and then you go from there. And I would still, with patients that have had workplace related injuries, that they come in with a migraine that is still there for months on end, I would give them prednisone. By the time they've seen you, they've already had imaging, their exam, you're not finding anything on exam. So you're like, why are they feeling this way? They have a migraine. So you treat it like a migraine. And, you know, the same way you would, you know, and a lot of times that helps break the cycle. And then once you break the cycle, then it's just like, okay, intermittent migraines, this is how we're going to treat it. And so you go from there. And so I've been very big on, you know, symptom management. You have to think about it in ways of how we manage symptoms with other neurologic conditions too, like sleep. We manage sleep with MS patients, neuroimmunology, epilepsy patients. We manage mood with them too. It's just the same kind of thing, the same thing. Yeah. And it is very, I've seen with patients that work in a certain setting that their symptoms aren't, because they have a neuro exam, their headaches aren't believed or their mood complaints are believed. So they're very defensive by the time they get to you. And so you just got to try to take the time. And I love a board to draw out the map.
Yeah.
So I draw out the graph and just, you know, this is the acute. And then it, you know, goes down, like that angle down. And sometimes people don't go right back to that y-axis. They kind of stay. Yeah, they kind of stay. They plateau. So, and then it's just like, we just got to bridge the gap.
Gotcha.
To get you back.
So yeah, so sometimes it'd be more helpful if people aren't as familiar with concussion and people, the sequelae of it, just treat it like it's individual components. Use the tools that you would normally have in your toolbox for yes. treating migraine, treating sleep, treating mood disorders. And it just so happens that they're all coincident with each other as a sequelae of the concussion itself.
Yes.
But there's nothing necessarily exotic or unusual about how you would manage them as a whole.
Yeah, no, it's not nothing too crazy.
Well, that's good to know.
Sorry, I think I misspoke. It goes from the peak of the y-axis and then it just kind of goes to the end of the x. And sometimes people don't hit that line. They kind of stay up and they plateau in this horrible phase of symptoms. And you just got to bridge the gap for them. But, you know, I can understand the fear and things that go on with that. But, you know, if you break it down into like a symptom, instead of seeing it like, oh, they had a concussion and I have to treat this huge, crazy thing, when you know that it's months later and it's an acute thing, you treat their symptoms. And if patients feel really well when their symptoms are treated, it's also, you know, difficult because they've been dealing with this for so long. So some patients don't believe they'll get better. And so you have that hurdle to kind of get over too. Like, just trust me. And that can be difficult.
Sure. Yeah. Especially, like you said, that they've been disbelieved by different people in the medical community for months on end while they feel terrible.
Yes. I mean, we all trust our neuro exam and we see the exam and we're like, your exam's fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, migrainers have normal exam too. You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, people with epilepsy often have normal exams, right? It's not, doesn't mean it's not serious.
Right. Yes, but, exactly.
But yeah, any final thoughts that you would say that people with like in primary care or neurology trainees or trainees in general should know when they're encountering people who have suffered concussions, either in the acute or the post phase?
You've had the training. Patients are fearful of concussions and the state that we have right now with everything, everyone's kind of fearful of it. But if you just take a kind of a step back and listen to the symptoms and the severity, and you just go from there, like, is it within that first week period? Have their symptoms, you know, the natural course is they start to feel better. And if they're not, you know, their symptoms weren't well managed, you manage your symptoms. You know, if not every concussion needs an MRI, but if it's going to make you feel better as in, you know, a provider to say that it is normal for them, you could do it. It'll help them and help you.
A sideline to that, you know, I know we sometimes get imaging to treat ourselves rather than our patients.
Yes.
But do you ever find that, like when you're trying to build that rapport with a patient, like we're going to get these symptoms under control by doing X, Y, and Z. If there's someone who is, let's say, more skeptical of your plan, will you say like, well, we'll get an MRI, we'll make sure everything looks okay. And is that a helpful strategy at times?
Yes, I have done that before. It can be helpful. And I tell patients, you know, some concussions or, you know, they do say MTBI, mild traumatic brain injuries. You can have like slight contusions that have, you know, in certain areas, but I do go over that, you know, this is likely normal. It'll be normal, but if they need it, I'll get it. And it's kind of a mixed bag. So some patients see the normal exam or see the normal MRI and they are mad because they're like, it's all in my head. And you, you know, and they are mad at themselves. They're mad at you. And then I tell them, it's not all, you have headaches. Like I told you have headaches. We can treat it. Or, you know, some patients see it as, well, there's something else going on and you just haven't found it. And so it's, if you can kind of lay the foundation as best you can, like, you know, the MRI is not going to necessarily change my management. I'm going to still want to do these things. But if it's going to help you for me to go over it, you know, once you get it, and I do, I go over all the sequences, the flare, the, you know, ADC WI to like explain which ones we use for the bleed, the T2, looking at their vessels, it helps for them because a lot of patients feel that they're broken because they've had this. And, you know, we as, you know, physicians or providers to just reassure them that this is something you can recover from. You can, you know, do great things still. There's a lot of fear out there with it. And there shouldn't be. I love to use one of my friends as an example. He's had like 4 and he's a neuroradiologist. He's one of the smartest people I know. So with rugby. So I'm like, yeah, no, there's a lot of fear and just you know, you get more comfortable with it and go from there. But yeah.
Yeah.
Or call, well, you know, you can always like curbside people to get their opinion too. Yeah.
It never hurts to get another opinion.
No, it doesn't. No.
Well, thank you so much for talking about concussion with me today. For anyone who wants to reach Dr. Misty Woodburn, please reach out to me either on Twitter at Dr. Kentris, DrKentris, or by email.
Yeah, that's a good way.
Dr. Woodburn, thank you again so much. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, review, and share it on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and please subscribe for future episodes. You can reach me on Twitter at Dr. Kentris, that's DrKentris, or by email at theneurotransmitterspodcast@gmail.com with any questions or show suggestions. We'll see you all next time.